If she were a wall, we would build upon her a battlement of silver. And if she were a door, she could be stopped up with cedar planking. That's my particular translation of Song of Songs, chapter 8, verse 9, from 2003, talking about the daughter who had no breasts, or sister, the little young, or young sister with no breasts in verse 8, was referred to there in verse 9. If she were a wall, we would build upon her a battlement of silver, and if she were a door, she could be stopped up with cedar planking. A very peculiar illustration, or series of illustrations there, which is not seen anywhere else in the Bible, and it's only in this Song of Solomon, and we know it's a Song of Solomon because we carry on here. We're going to see in a few verses the name of Solomon is mentioned too. And of course, Jewish tradition also gives us a lot of information about who wrote which books and all that sort of thing. But continuing now in our article, The Ark of Urartu, The Orient Express, Chapter 3, we've come to the final paragraph. I'm going to skip over the last part of paragraph 11 because these numbers, while they're remarkable, amazing numbers, with the factors of 13 and the divine factor of 7 there, the date for the deluge, which was given there, December 7th, 3282 BCE, was modified later in the article Preservation, chapter 8, paragraph 11 of Preservation, where we did some analysis. Now, we don't really know whether this is more true than what we wrote about in the Ark of Urartu about December 7th, but here we obtained a time period of, let's see now, December 30th, 3283, which was an important date because it was in the year 3283 BCE, was a conjunction, December 30th, conjunction of the moon. And January 17th was Lunar Day 17, and we ended up saying that this appears to have been, because it was also Phaophi 27, and Phaophi is the second month, isn't it, of the Egyptian calendar? Now my memory's, I'm unable to come up with that number at this moment. Let's see, let's check. What's the second month of the, if we go back in months, let's go back. Yeah, Phaophi is the second month after Thoth, Phaophi. So that's the second Egyptian month in the Egyptian calendar. And we were looking at this article, Preservation, here. So, yeah, in that Chapter 8, paragraph 11 of Preservation is where we are. And this Lunar Day 17 looks like it's also, it is exactly, actually, Phaophi. Not knowing how to pronounce the month Phaophi, but that's how we're pronouncing it. Phaophi 27 in the Egyptian calendar corresponds to Lunar Day 17 in that year, after December 30th, 3283, which was January of 3282. And since Genesis dates the deluge as the 27th day of the second month, and Phaophi is the second month in the Egyptian calendar, we came to the idea that January 17th was the deluge date in the year 3282, which is, you know, it's about 11 months or 10 months and some days, I guess, earlier than what we had said, just for reference, in this article here. It's just important that we make a note that we did some more work on this deluge date later on. But if this had been true, and all of our work is hypothetical when we're talking about ancient dates, if this date, December 7th, were true, then we'd have 507 equals 3 times 13 times 13, which is the number of years that the eclipse of Nimrod happened after the deluge. And that's what I did at the end of paragraph 11 that we didn't get to yesterday because we ran out of time. So 3 times 13 equals 507, as was given in the paragraph 11. And then we have this other number, the number of days, let's see, more than 507 years, before which the deluge occurred prior to the eclipse, was 224. And let's do that now. 224, it's 2 to the 5th power. 2 to the 5th times 7, 224. See that? So there's a divine factor of 7 in that calculation. And plus the number 2 to the 5th, actually 2 plus 5 also equals 7. I mean, there's a lot of divinity, it seems like, in some of these dates. So which dates are correct, we'd have to be very hardworking in trying to evaluate these ancient dates. Now, let's continue our study, shall we? In the article, the Ark of Urartu, chapter 3, paragraph 12, at the beginning of it, we have this picture, a drawing made by somebody, not really known, who made it. It could have been somebody associated with Ron Wyatt, or Ron Wyatt having been somebody who investigated the Ark site, but the original resting site near the top of the mountain ridge was shown there at the top. The ship was carried down by lava flow was the hypothesis, and it was impaled upon limestone, an outcropping of limestone at the bottom here. It says it rotates into alignment with the lava flow and is covered in lava. Well, if it had been covered in lava, then it would have been quite remarkable, even more remarkable that the earthquake that occurred sometime after Ron Wyatt saw the site for the first time in 1977 of the Common Era, that earthquake would have been all the more remarkable if it could have removed the lava. So I'm not sure that there was lava or if it was just mud. We don't really know everything about it as these events occurred over centuries of time, perhaps. We don't really know. But let's continue reading. We know that the Ark, as it's positioned today, that how it is, and we know that there was an earthquake that occurred after 1977 when Ron saw the Ark for the first time. The amazing, as we continue now reading, the amazing annular solar eclipse of Friday, July 18th, 2774 BCE, occurred on the first day of the Egyptian calendar. That's Thoth 1, in other words. That's just what day it was in the Egyptian calendar. We can calculate back because we know at some point in the Egyptian calendar there was a known date. That was, I think it was 139 of the Common Era, but 100 years after Jesus' time. There was a given date that we know of, or even during Ptolemy's time, I think. There's a date that we know of in the Egyptian calendar, and from that known date we calculate. We can go backwards in time in our Julian calendar and get back to Thoth 1 in this year, 2774. And we know, therefore, that as long as the Egyptian calendar didn't change all those years, then July 18th is the same as Thoth 1, the beginning of the Egyptian calendar in that year. And therefore, and since the Egyptian calendar, Thoth 1 also happened to be the rising of the dog star Sothis, which only happens every 1460 years. This is very likely the very beginning of the Egyptian calendar in 2774, because it was synchronized with the rising of the dog star, which was an event very greatly celebrated by the Egyptians. The ancient Egyptians, the first day of the Egyptian calendar was synchronized to an heliacal rising of the dog star Sothis in that year. And only at that year, 2774, and then another 1400 and some years after that, did it synchronize again. It had its maximum effect at Noah's Ark in Uzengeli. That is, the solar eclipse had its maximum effect at Noah's Ark, because that's where it occurred, right? Along that path that went through, at least there were many places along that path, but Uzengeli was one of those places that fell on that path of the eclipse, as computed by Solex 10, the program I used, written by Aldo Vitagliano. And by now there's version 12 at least of that program, but it hasn't changed much in the interim. The odds of it occurring, this eclipse, the odds of it occurring, it's fully a pun to say the odds are astronomical. Narmer's palette has recorded what looks to be an eclipse. We saw that. So Nimrod evidently was ruling Egypt by the year 2774. We have identified Narmer with Nimrod, and so with Qi Yu, the Chinese warrior. It is whelming to believe that it may never again be said, and I'm quoting, modern historians are unable to determine any certain date for the beginning of the quote-unquote historical period of mankind. That's from Insight on the Scriptures, Watchtower, Bible and Tract Society under Chronology. That might be from 1988 version of the Insight on the Scriptures, but it's a quote from the Insight book, as they call it. Modern historians are unable to determine any certain date for the beginning of the historical period of mankind. So, are we, how certain may we be then? This looks like a fairly certain date because it's coinciding with an eclipse, which also coincided with the beginning of the Egyptian calendar. It's also, of course, because it's an eclipse, it also means it's a solar eclipse, right? Which means it's a lunar day one. Also, or a conjunction rather, you know, and it makes sense to begin. What else did it coincide with? The rising of the dog star, the beginning of the Egyptian calendar, and a solar eclipse. I mean, how certain do you need to be? So it's curious. I like to use those quotes of how impossible things are after we've already shown that we may have proven something for certain. Then we quote from these people, whoever they are, it's different people at different times who say that it's not possible or people are unable to do it. So maybe we can make their statement appear somewhat less important when they say it's that we're unable to do it. But Nimrod was a rebel. It makes sense, therefore, to begin counting his rule from the time of this historic eclipse, 2774 BCE. That's what we're saying. There is great meaning to be derived from this occurrence because it means that the ancients were very interested in the celestial phenomena, for one thing, and knew Dog Star. The star Sothis is called the Dog Star. That's where we get the phrase Dog Days of Summer, because the rising of this star occurred in the summertime in July, right? I am terribly excited about this discovery because in the future, all history from the deluge on will be fixed by our annular solar eclipse during the reign of Narmer of Egypt. I was so excited when I wrote this, too. July 18th, 2774 BCE. Acts now as a go-between point for times between the deluge of 3282 BCE and 2774 BCE. And that date, 3282, that year did not change. When we went to the article preservation, the month of the deluge changed from December to the previous January, but the year didn't change. Between the deluge and 20, the deluge of 3282 BCE and 2774 BCE. This July 18th, 2774 BCE, is a go-between between those two dates, and also for times after 2774 BCE, I'm reading here, when a start was made by Genesis 10, quote, in my translation, Cush is ancestor to Nimrod, who made the start in becoming a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty ruler from God. As they do say, just like Nimrod, a mighty ruler from God. Ward Green translation, Genesis 10, verses 8 and 9. When we believe this eclipse to be the time of Nimrod, and yet we continue consistent with our Christian faith, it is finally possible to say that Nimrod, the mighty ruler from God of the Bible, is not the same person as Sargon, who is dated by us as ruling in 2268 BCE. So 2700 BC, 2200. So not close in period. The myth of confusion which entangled the identities of so very many rulers of history shall never be the same again. A correction for the latitude of Eridu compared to Memphis adds 4 years to the year of heliacal rise of Sothis, also called Sirius, which appears to shift the beginning of the Tower of Babel, since Sothis would have risen at Eridu, possibly in 2778 BCE, well, not possibly, but definitely, but it may shift it possibly, if we believe that the rising of the star was observed at Eridu instead of Memphis. Now, why would it have been observed at Memphis? We don't know either, because we're not saying that they were located in Memphis at the time of 2774. So maybe they were at Eridu, and maybe it was 2778. We're just going to try that and see how it works out here in this paragraph. A date which is exactly, that is 2778, exactly 43 years before. 43 years before 2735 is 2778. The date we have proposed, which is 2735, that is, as the year in which King Nimrod was killed by Hake. We proposed that above. Nimrod, in the book of Jasher, rules 185 years. Exactly the difference between 2735 and 2550. 100 added to 2550 is 2650, and 85 on to 2650 is 2735. So that's correct. The date 2550 BCE being 3,000 years after Adam is created in 5550 BCE in the genealogy. And the 3,000 years after Adam was the time that Nimrod passes away from the Kitab al-Magal. So that's quite a coincidence there. A great many possible chronologies will now have to be put under examination by a multitude of counselors from Proverbs 15:22, the dynasty of Nimrod. Something about salvation in the multitude of counselors is what Proverbs says, or wisdom in the multitude of counselors. There's a proverb there to look up. The Bible consistently says wisdom or salvation in the multitude of counselors. The dynasty of Nimrod has been given, is another fact, as 190 or 225 years. Now we see that in Mr. Jackson's work for one place. That's one place where we see that. And he talks about that, I believe, I think he even talks about the reason for the difference between those two numbers. But we also, we see there are numbers given for the dynasty of Nimrod in the book of Manetho too. We see there's the book, the account of Africanus, and there's the account of Eusebius, which we could look at if we have time. Let's see, what have we got here? Let's go down and see if we can jump down. I have to always jump down into the book to find it, if I'm going to find it at all. I don't know if I'm going to find it quickly. The Egyptian history, where is it? It's a beautiful list. of all the Egyptian dynasties found in Fotheringham's book, The Chronology of the Old Testament. Here it is. Okay, finally got there. Yeah, so Menes, he said, 263 according to Africanus, or 253 is what it's stated as being, but it adds up to 263 years for Dynasty 1. But in Eusebius, it's stated as 252 and adds up to 228, you see. So we get numbers from Dynasty 1, or about, concerning the length of Dynasty 1, also from Manetho. And now, returning to our study of this paragraph, which said 190 or 225, that was from Jackson. Jackson talks about all these things that we're talking about now here in his Chronological Antiquities from 1752. That's an excellent thing to look at. Maybe it's hard to read all of it, but to look at the portions where he talks about this, it's useful. And I've quoted it throughout my articles with the references of what page and so on. But there was said to be an Arabian dynasty which followed this dynasty of Nimrod, and which lasted for 215 years. That's the Arabian dynasty, ending some time near 2233 BCE, near the reign of Belus, who started astronomical records. We talked about the 2233 as having been calculable based on the number of years of records and the time they were last recorded, as discovered by the servant of Alexander the Great, who found these records, and then they calculated, or we calculate back from that time period to give us the beginning of those astronomical records in 2233. The observations of Bell, is the name of the book, of the ancient book, working upwards from Sargon, whom we call Belus. And the book was called The Observations of Bel, Bel being the name of the god, Belus being the name of the king, Sargon we think he is. Working upwards from Sargon, we had 215 then, since he was the beginning of the dynasty that followed the Arabian dynasty. So we add the Arabian dynasty 215 years to 2268, the beginning of Sargon's rule in the particular analysis we gave in this article so far. We get 215 plus 2268, which gives us 2483. Let's see. Plus 2268 plus 215, 2483. That's 252 years after. Okay, let's add 252 after 2735, which is thus 62 years more than 190. 252, we just looked at that. And it was stated, the Eusebian account of Manetho gave Dynasty 1 as 252. It stated the number as 252, even though it only added up to 228. But 252 comes from that. It's hard to see when everything gets dimmed out. I can't see the... I mean, it's impossible for anyone to see it, really. Not that my vision is bad for that distance or to look at that. It's got to do with the size and the dimness. But, okay, who started astronomical records? Belus, right. Okay, we got to the 252, and that's 252 years after 2735, which is thus 62 years more than 190, which was given by Jackson for the Nimrod dynasty in his book, unless we are prepared to throw away the date of 2233 BCE, the start of astronomy, say, we're saying it's maybe the start of astronomy, we are inclined to delve into the time of the 62 years and the reason for its existence. First, though, the time from the deluge to to 2778 BCE, or the tower, is 504 years. 2778 plus 504, 3282. That's the deluge, so that's confirmed, or exactly 2 times 252 years. 504 divided by 2, 252 years. And the build on the tower was begun 2 years after Shem's death, 2778, being 2 years after 2780, which was the death of Shem. This also dates the Narmer palette to the eclipse of 2774, so the eclipse year, that stays the same. It's still 2774. Of course, we can't change the date of the eclipse. Or we're not trying to change it. When we believe that Sheila Shenong lived, you can't change the date of an eclipse. That's because it's based on calculations that are, you know, well-established calculations astronomical calculations that don't change, really. They're constant unless we change everything that we believe about the way the planets and the moon and the sun move. When we believe that, and we don't change that because it's been proven to be accurate, so that eclipse won't move. When we believe that Sheila Shenong lived 460 years, it is seen that Nimrod and his immediate posterity might have lived comparably long lives, which renders the time of 252 years said to be six reigns. That is, it's said to be, it's accounted for as six different kings ruling during that time period. That's from maybe Manetho, is it? We have to check that again. One, two, three. Well, there's eight kings given there by Eusebius, but said to be six reigns. Probably it's Jackson who said it was six reigns. But it's still 42 years per reign on average for 252 years, which is seemingly small, although double the number typical today. We say about 22 years per reign or 21 years per reign in the modern or more recent times, like even the time, you know, 600 or 1,000 years BC, it was much more like 21 years per reign on average, because it wasn't every firstborn son. There were interruptions in the lineage of in the kingship, and it was sometimes the uncle or the brother who was the king, not always a descent line, which would have been 27 years on average per reign if it were father and son, firstborn sons. I'm guessing Nimrod, born in 2887 BCE, and his son Enmerkara, the more famous Nimrod, born in 2765 BCE, dying in 2550. These are just numbers, I'm guessing. This supposes a yet unsupported order of events, and it endeavors to accommodate whatever information gifts tell. Yeah, we don't have any real certainty about this part. As we said before, about much of it, we're not certain because it's so ancient anyway. As we said before, many counselors will be required, which without writ means many impositions will have to be tried. We need to be, you know, flexible, try all kinds of different ideas and see what fits, is what I'm saying. And Cush-born, here's some more guesses. Cush-born 3149, Mizraim-born 3018, Nimrod-born 2887 BCE. All these having been born before the eclipse of 2774. And the final reference was just the reference for the quotation we saw earlier. The quotation from the insight on the scriptures. Okay, that's it for our study for today. We finally got through it all. That's the end of chapter 3 of the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express. And it shows how much and yet how little can be achieved in establishing dates of such an ancient time period. It's really how very difficult. So we really depend on the ancient sources, because we have nothing, no other information. And the Bible is not just one of the best, it's the best ancient source of all, because it has proven to be reliable in so many more ways than any other sources. But, you know, it doesn't give us the dates like we can obtain using astronomy, and it doesn't give us all of that, but it shows us how to get these dates at Genesis 1:14, where it says that the heavenly bodies are given to us to determine the times and seasons. Now, the ark lands on Misha Island. There's a beautiful, beautiful picture. This is, again, I think this is probably from Ron Wyatt. Ron Wyatt did some simulations on how the ark could have landed. At the time, this is the wall of heaven that we saw in the photograph and shown below here too. As seen today, the wall of heaven is a mountain at the top of the mountain. And during the deluge, it was just barely above the level of the water at the time the ark landed, is what this drawing is showing. So it shows the ark had drogue anchor stones that were dragging behind it before the anchor stones were ditched some miles away, when the drogue stones possibly began dragging on the ground, or whatever the reason was, they ditched them. And the ark came into land in this bay, or this place. It's not a bay, really. But Ron had done all these simulations to find out what shape of land would be required to allow the ark to make a landing, you know, because different shapes or curvatures of the mountaintop would cause the ark to not make an easy landing. It would tend to not go in, but it would tend to go, as these arrows are showing, it would go around and miss. And we don't know exactly how navigable the ark was, but it may not have been very easy to navigate such a large boat, of course. So this is really a remarkable thing. That might even be illustrating, I'm not sure what that on the left of the ark is, whether that's illustrating the walk, the plank, the gangway by which they disembarked, or whether that's something else. Don't know what that is. But the ark would have needed to make a landing here, somewhere at the top of this mountain, which included at the top of Mount Judy here, where the wall of heaven, which is adjacent to the Mount Judy, which is on the right in this lower picture, Mount Judy, in Turkey, at the site near Uzungili, where the ark is still found today. Beautiful picture, Misha Island it's called here, which at that time would have been just barely above the water. That's it for today's study. It's October 9th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 1955 hours North American Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. And on my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie, saying bye for now. Thanks for listening and watching.